Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
The same religion that's capable of hideous acts of destruction can also be capable of moments of healing, of restoration, and of hope.
But educate a girl, and you educate her entire family.
There is a son within every person.
When that anger sets in, write it. Write the letters, but don't send them. You never want to leave concrete proof of insanity.
Great privilege to introduce a man who is chairman of the board of the Peace Foundation and a man who is so smart that every time he lowers his head to gather his thoughts, I feel like running away because I know he's looking at me with his mind's eye and he's about to just reveal something that I would have never thought of in a million years. His name is Professor Richard Falk. Please come up.
My reason for being here is a very happy one. It is to introduce one of our two wonderful honorees. We're very proud at the foundation to have such individuals of stature, accomplishment, and of extraordinary human qualities. I was very fortunate to have known Glenn Page over a period of approaching 50 years. We crossed paths initially as young, anxious, and insecure professors at Princeton University. He moved to a much more beautiful part of the world and left me, abandoned me, but I've forgiven him for that. But in all seriousness, there are very few academic engagements that are as impressive and persevering as the one that Glenn Page has made over the course of almost his entire adult life. He will leave an unforgettable legacy by this articulation of a visionary possibility of what he, in a very imaginative and original way, calls a non-killing political science. See, and it's very counter-cultural in the best sense. Most of our universities have contributed to a killing political science. How do we use our military strength to achieve our national goals? How do we intervene successfully in foreign societies? But Glenn Page has, throughout his career, been asking the opposite question. Can we imagine and achieve a non-killing political science? And by that he means a new form of social science that is testable. The idea of a non-killing as distinct from a non-violent political perspective is that life and death create a measurable threshold. And all of his life, he's been an exemplary social scientist. And even in this latest dedication and commitment, it is one of going swimming against the current and doing it, though, as a rigorous, disciplined political scientist. And it should be said that it hasn't been easy. He submitted his distinguished volume on non-killing political science to 20 of the leading publishers, and all of them rejected it. And so he published it himself through his own resources. It's now been translated into 22 languages and will remain as a important milestone in efforts to think our way beyond the entrapment of humanity in the war system and militarism. So it is a wonderful privilege to welcome Glenn Page as an honoree tonight, and one that makes all of us very proud, and as a friend, particularly so.
You'll note that I've greeted you with a gesture of non-killing respect for you and for all life. It comes from the non-violent Jain tradition of India. Since air, like earth and water, is essential for life, Jains avoid conventional clapping as doing violence to life. I invite you to try it out and add it to your repertoire of non-violent actions. You'll note that it produces an electric group atmosphere of respect for life. Try it out. You look around the room. See how it feels. It's a great honor for me and my wife, Glenda, along with co-directors Greg Bourne and Tom Field, the Center for Global Nonkilling, to be with Reverend Lawson, all of you, and with leaders of the pioneering Nuclear AIDS Peace Foundation, among whom I cherish friendships with Board Chair Professor Richard Falk, respected colleague from Princeton days, inspiring poet director Dr. David Krieger, and former Army Captain Paul Chappelle, who contributed by Skype to the second Global Nonkilling Leadership Academy program in Honolulu, completed just 2 weeks ago. Gandhi said, "My life is my message." In this case, however, the message is not the life, but a question. The question is a non-killing society possible? Is it possible for us humans to stop killing each other, from the family to the global community? The question is unusual. For one thing, because the word non-killing is not yet in a standard English dictionary. Let's take a vote. What do you think right now? We might change our minds tomorrow. How many say no? Okay. How many say yes? Oh, the question is it? Okay. Here's the question. Here we go again. Is a non-killing society possible? Is it possible where humans don't kill each other? So how many say no? All right. How many say yes? All right. How many say yes and no? How many say I don't know? How many abstain? Good. Whatever you now think, yes or no, you're invited to explore grounds for confidently answering yes. They're set forth in the book Non-Killing Global Political Science. First published in 2002, it has been translated, as Dick Falk said, into 22 languages and 13 more in progress. It's including into Arabic, French, German, Hindi, Italian, Korean, Portuguese, Russian, and Urdu, Chinese and Japanese translations forthcoming. There are grassroots teaching editions in Haitian Creole, in Ogoni and Ijaw of the Niger Delta, and Kiswahili of Great Lakes Africa, the DR Congo, Burundi, and Rwanda. There are many grounds for confidence that we can stop killing each other. Most humans have never killed anyone. Have you killed anybody recently? Otherwise, humanity long ago would have spiraled into extinction. 95 countries have completely abolished the death penalty. 27 countries have no armies. 47 countries accept conscious objection to military service. Spiritual traditions and humanist philosophies proscribe killing. Science promises new understanding of causes and prevention of killing. Components for non-killing societies already have been demonstrated somewhere in human experience. If creatively combined and adapted in any single place, non-killing societies can be approximated even now anywhere. In short, knowledge exists to assist crossing the threshold of lethal pessimism to confidently envision a non-killing global human future. Since ideas can lead, the Distinguished Leadership Award in this case needs to be directed not to a person, but to leadership by an idea, the idea that a killing-free world is possible. The non-killing leadership story is a remarkable one. It starts with spirit, no more killing. Spirit becomes a question. Is a non-killing society possible? The question becomes an answer, yes. The answer becomes an organization, a Center for Global Non-Killing, focused upon advancing research, education, training, and putting knowledge into action and nurturing global non-killing leaders. The organization affirms the global non-killing spirit, which is invoked in the following way. In remembrance of all who have been killed, of all the killers, of all who have not killed, and of all who have worked to end killing, guided by the global non-killing spirit, taught by faith and found within, we pledge ourselves and call upon all to work toward the measurable goal of a killing-free world with infinite creativity in reverence for life. The spirit guides the message to promote change toward the measurable goal of a killing-free world by means of infinite creativity with reverence for life. Miracles begin to happen, such as Humanity United, founded by Pamela Omidyar, steps forth in 2008 with strategic planning and capacity building support for the unique Center for Global Non-Killing in 2009 and 2010 to carry forth the vision and accomplishments of its predecessor, Center for Global Nonviolence, founded in 1994. The vision seeks to evoke the spiritual, the scientific, the skill, and the artistic creativity of non-killing humankind. Then, the thesis of non-killing global political science escapes the bounds of political science, begins to question the killing accepting assumptions of other academic disciplines. In 2009, young Sean Evans Pym, he's only 26 years old, in Spain, edits and publishes Toward a Non-Killing Paradigm, engaging 22 authors in 15 disciplines, including chapters on non-killing history, non-killing mathematics, what's that, and non-killing engineering. And in addition, Schwab mobilizes 375 scholars in 200 universities in 50 countries in 20 non-killing research committees. He creates a series of books by multiple authors, published or forthcoming, including non-killing societies by anthropologists, non-killing history by historians, non-killing engineering, non-killing psychology, and non-killing Korea six culture exploration. Planned out volumes on non-killing economics, futures, geography, linguistics, spiritual traditions, and so forth. Another miracle. Spontaneously, organizations and movements begin to carry the non-killing idea into research, education, and action. They arise in Brazil, Colombia, Germany, Haiti, India, the Philippines, and Great Lakes Africa. A little non-killing school for 230 children aged 5 to 6 and 7 to 9 with 5 teachers arises in the village of Kazimia on the banks of Lake Tanganyika in the DR Congo. A pioneering non-killing anthropology course is created by Professor Leslie Sponsel at the University of Hawaii. On nurturing leadership, in 2009 and 2010, the first two global non-killing leadership academies are held to bring young women and men together for 2 weeks to share experiences and to make plans for non-killing social change in their societies. They review lessons from leaders like Queen Liliuokalani, Gandhi, King, Abdul Ghaffar Khan, Ron Maloney, Petro Kelly, and Governor Guillermo Gaviria of Colombia. Participants come from Bangladesh, Colombia, Germany, Haiti, Hawaii, Ireland, India, Israel, Italy, Kenya, Liberia, Palestine, Philippines, Thailand, Trinidad, and Western Sahara. Going forward, the Center for Global Nonkilling becomes a partner of the WHO Violence Prevention Alliance in its work to eliminate human violence, suicide, homicide, and collective violence as a, quote, preventable disease. Introduced by Nobel Peace Laureate Murray Maguire, the center becomes a friend of the Nobel Peace Laureates World Summits and contributes to Principle 13 of the Charter for a World Without Violence. Everyone has the right not to be killed and the responsibility not to kill others. What does a non-killing idea mean for support for the work of the Nuclear AIDS Peace Foundation and other great organizations that celebrate life while working for a world free of war and other threats to human survival and well-being? It simply means adding non-killing confidence to inspired work for nuclear disarmament and security, economic well-being, freedom and human rights, protection of the biosphere, and every other issue requiring universal problem-solving cooperation. The non-killing idea seeks a killing-free world achieved by global diffusion of a strong non-killing ethic, combined with global citizen understanding of ways and means to bring it about. It is a process in which each human being who shares the air and precious gift of life on Earth, now and in the future, becomes a center for global non-killing. And so I share with you a non-killing gesture, a question: is a non-killing society possible? An answer, yes, and some evidence that the ancient non-killing idea is beginning to lead anew in the 21st century. More can be found on the website of the Center for Global Nonkilling, nonkilling.org. To all of you, Glenda and I bring warmest aloha from Hawaii.
I get the opportunity to introduce a man who I got to work with. It was great joy. And who I have a lot of admiration for, because along with three other gentlemen, he founded the Nuclear AIDS Peace Foundation in 1982. He knew that the world needed to take action. And since then, he's dedicated his life to working towards peace and to working towards a world free of nuclear weapons. Please welcome David Krieger, President of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation.
The lives of our two honorees, like the lives of so many other individuals in this country and throughout the world, have been deeply affected by war. Reverend James Lawson, who you will hear from in a moment, was a conscientious objector during the Korean War, for which he spent time in prison. It helped mold his life as a leader in peace and nonviolence, and then as a mentor to Martin Luther King, Jr. Professor Glenn Page served as an enlisted man and officer in the Korean War, and then wrote a book justifying that war. Later, he would take the unusual step of criticizing his own book and conclude that there was no justification for killing in that war or in any war. For both men, the experience of war changed the course of their lives and put them on the path to peace. One of the great myths of our time is that war creates peace. It does not. War breeds war, laying the groundwork for future wars. As Martin Luther King Jr. observed, wars are poor chisels for carving out peaceful tomorrows. We must pursue peaceful ends through peaceful means. As our 2007 honorees, Peter, Paul, and Mary, famous singing group, asked in song, when will we ever learn? War kills not only with bullets and bombs, it also kills indirectly by robbing the world's people of the resources necessary for survival. As President Eisenhower emphasized in his farewell address, every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. The world is spending more than $1.5 trillion annually on war and its preparation. While it does so, the United Nations struggles to raise the needed resources to meet its 8 Millennium Development Goals, which are to eradicate poverty and hunger, achieve universal primary education, promote gender equality and empower women, reduce child mortality, improve maternal health, combat HIV/AIDS, malaria, and other diseases, ensure environmental sustainability, and build a global partnership for development. What is amazing is that for only 5 to 10% of global military expenditures annually for the next 5 years, the world could reach the markers that have been set for these Millennium Development Goals by the year 2015. Instead, we choose to use our scientific and financial resources to build and deploy ever more powerful weapons. It is a soul-deadening exercise. War and violence are the enemies of humanity. There is a better way forward, as shown in the lives of our honorees, based upon nonviolence and non-killing. At the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, we believe that nuclear weapons have made peace an imperative of the nuclear age. We must eliminate these weapons, which threaten civilization and the human future, and we must also eliminate war. That is the work of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, and we need all of you to join with us to achieve our goals. Let me give you a few relevant statistics about the foundation. Our membership is over 37,000 people. More than 30,000 individuals participate in our Action Alert Network, sending messages relevant to political actions. Our Peace Leadership Program Director, Paul Chappell, a 2002 West Point graduate who served for 7 years after that in the military and joined us last year, has given over 100 talks in the last year to high schools, universities, churches, activist organizations, and veterans groups throughout the country. There are over 2,100 people now in our peace leadership program. Some 700,000 people have visited our wagingpeace.org and nuclearfiles.org websites in the past year. Our Sunflower e-newsletter is distributed to tens of thousands of people throughout the world. We are intent upon breaking down the walls of ignorance, apathy, and complacency that surround issues of nuclear weapons and war, and replacing them with new and abundant energy and commitment directed toward peace and human survival. This is the responsibility to future generations demanded of those of us alive on our planet today. With 6 hardworking and talented staff members and dozens of volunteers, including a dedicated board, our distinguished advisors and associates, and our enthusiastic and competent college interns, we are committed to building a safer and saner world. We educate and advocate to abolish nuclear weapons, strengthen international law and institutions, and empower new generations of peace leaders. Let me conclude with 3 short quotations from 3 giants of the 20th century. Albert Camus, an existential philosopher and Nobel laureate in literature, said, "I have always held that if he who bases his hopes on human nature is a fool, he who gives up in the face of circumstances is a coward. And henceforth, the only honorable course will be to stake everything on a formidable gamble, that words are more powerful than munitions." Albert Einstein, the great scientist and humanist who changed our understanding of the universe, said, "The world is a dangerous place to live, not because of the people who are evil, but because of the people who don't do anything about it." Eleanor Roosevelt, who was the driving force behind the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, said, "The future belongs to those who believe in the beauty of their dreams." It is in the creative tension between words and action that we must seek to fulfill our dreams. May we never lose hold of the dream of peace. May we choose hope and find a way to change the world. May we each do our part to pass the world on intact to the next generation. Thank you very much.
Rabbi Abraham Heschel wrote a brilliant book about the ancient prophets. And in that book, he described a term, divine pathos. And he suggested that the ancient prophets actually could feel God's suffering for a suffering world. And that they could actually feel God's passion for a different kind of world. And because the ancient prophets had this voice and this vision, they were actually able to change the hearts and minds of communities and of entire nations so that they could move them in a completely different direction. Tonight we honor a contemporary prophet in Reverend James Lawson. I say that because everything I've heard and I've read about James Lawson reveals that he is truly moved from a divine passion. For Reverend Lawson, the civil rights protests were not just a political movement. He has said it was a moment in history when God saw fit to call America back from the depths of moral depravity and onto a path of righteousness. Reverend Lawson is one of those who believes that war is just not a beautiful piece, a beautiful state of mind. It truly means the absence, that peace is not just a beautiful state of mind, but it truly means the absence of war. And it truly means the absence of violence. Reverend Lawson went to prison for that belief, as we've already noted tonight. In 1951, he declared himself a conscientious objector. I can't even imagine what kind of courage it took in 1951 to declare yourself a conscientious objector. He went to prison for that decision. After his release from prison, he went to India as a Methodist missionary, where he studied the Gandhian method of nonviolent resistance. He returned to the United States and entered graduate school at Oberlin College. And at that time, Reverend Lawson was teaching growing numbers of black and white students how to organize sit-ins and many other forms of action that would force America to confront the immorality of segregation. In 1957, a professor introduced him to Martin Luther King. And it was Dr. King who recognized the work of James Lawson as a model for nonviolence. He recognized that Reverend Lawson had produced the blueprint for the nonviolence in this emerging movement. Reverend Lawson helped coordinate the Freedom Rides in 1961, the Meredith March in 1966. He spent 17 years as a Methodist minister in Tennessee, and he invited Martin Luther King to speak in Memphis. A day after giving that famous mountaintop speech, which we all remember and we all know about, Dr. King was assassinated. But in that famous last speech, Dr. King referred to James Lawson as a noble man who influenced the black freedom struggle, and that he is the leading theorist and strategist for nonviolence in the world. The same can be said for Reverend Lawson today. He served as pastor of Holman United Methodist Church in Los Angeles for more than 25 years. He continues to train activists in nonviolence, supporting numbers of causes, including the rights of immigrants, Palestinians, opposition to the war in Iraq, workers' rights, the list goes on and on. In 2004, he received the Community of Christ International Peace Award, and he currently serves as Distinguished Professor at Vanderbilt University. On behalf of the Board of Directors of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, it is the greatest honor to present the 2010 Peace Leadership Award to Reverend James Lawson.
Things that we have heard this evening are just wonderful, marvelous. And the way in which this foundation and David Krieger and the board have sought to push the matter of peace, the end of war, the end of nuclear weapons, is for me a great shot of encouragement and adrenaline to keep on keeping on. I have friends in this audience, and I'm delighted to see them as well, to walk in and see Stanley Scheinbaum here, one of my own personal heroes, but a man with whom I've been related in a great variety of ways over the last 35 or 40 years, remains a stalwart figure in the tradition of what Joshua Heschel spoke as the God's pathos, God's passion. He is a wonderful illustration of that. I looked over the invitation this evening fairly carefully at home for several days, and I noticed you have Glenn Page and I joining a distinguished group of people. And I want to express my own humility with this list of people. I appreciate all that Glenn Page has done. He belongs in that category. His non-killing notion and politics, tremendous. I think it's an idea whose time has come, and I want to especially applaud it. We can have another kind of society. I decided, in fact, that I wanted to address quite briefly from the perspective of one of the members of your advisory council. Harrison Ford, who is, in addition to his fame and celebrity in acting, an environmentalist who has worked in many different parts of the country as well as the United States. And this past January, I was taking a trip somewhere on Southwest Airlines, and as I often do, I picked up their monthly magazine called The Spirit. And in that issue, January's issue, there was this conversation between Bill Ford of the Ford Company and Harrison Ford. A conversation around the issues of the environmental movement and the struggle. They have both participated in this cause around the world. They know each other from that participation. It's a very interesting piece, but towards the end of the piece, Harrison Ford, after talking with Bill Ford about environmental issues and the movement and the struggle, says something like this, and I'm not going to quote it exactly, but I'm going to give you literally what he said. He said what he sees now, after the years that he's given to it, he sees the failure of the environmental movement. And he suggested something that I think is a point of strategy that has interested me ever since. He said the movement has failed because we have worked over the years from issue to issue and from species to species. And that made a vivid picture in my mind as I followed that movement across these decades. And then he said, in concluding his critique of his own work and of a great movement, what we need is a movement like the civil rights movement of a few years ago. So that's going to frame the structure of what I have to say this evening. in many ways, we who are the advocates of peace and we who want peace have obviously failed in our own country and in the world. But one can say this about the civil rights movement. One can say this about the anti-poverty movement. One can say this about the living wage movement, of which I've been a part for some now 25 years, I suspect. Many of the critical issues that you and I have worked for and believe in and imagined have, over the last 30 years, probably 30 years, maybe more, have simply not taken off in the mind of people, in the mind of the nation, and we know our work remains in many, many different ways and forms. We of the peace movement have failed. In the first instance, across these last 30 years, we 300 million plus a few of this land are now participating in a nation that is, as David has said here, which I have rarely heard anyone say, nation which, because of its military power and financial power, has become the, as Martin King said, the progenitor of violence around the world. I've said it like this in the past. We of the United States, intentionally or unintentionally, as it is, has become the number one enemy of peace and justice in the world today. We've become the one number one military power, par none today or in the past. 800 military installations in 130 countries with naval fleets and with air fleets and with military people on the ground, with massive technology, yes, even with nuclear weapons at our for our use, rather. The nation has become a military security nation in many different ways, whether we've liked it or not, or whether we ourselves have been victims of it. But a major way in which we've failed is that we're in a society now where there's tremendous confusion and animosity, the lack of civil conversation and discussion, the unwillingness to put on the table the issues that we feel deeply about and the issues that are hurting and paining millions of our fellow citizens around the country, of all complexions and in all parts of the country. Our own visions for our land are being smashed steadily by a media that talks and talks and talks and talks and talks, but very rarely about real human beings, very rarely about our country, very rarely about this magnificent 300 million people that we represent. On almost every issue in the present electoral scheme, there is little common sense being put on the table. There is very little wisdom from our own past as a nation, and the wisdom of the human race is nowhere to be found to that extent in most of the election campaigns. And I'm sure there are few where that's not the case, but most of the ones we hear about and read about, that wisdom from our own ancestry of the human race is simply not there. Take this matter of the nuclear weapons. This issue is a very personal issue with me. August the 6th, 1945, I was preparing for my senior year in high school in Massillon, Ohio, when the bomb dropped on the 6th, Nagasaki, and then the second bomb on Hiroshima on August the 9th. For quite a number of years now, I've tried to observe those 2 days in some ways of contemplation and peace. Within a few days after the 9th of August, the National Forensic League of the country sent out urgent letters to high schools across the country saying the topic that had been designated for 1945-46 has been changed. It is now, does the atomic bomb make mass armies obsolete? So for the next 9 months, my colleagues and I in that Washington High School studied and explored and read about this question, about which there was very little written. It was 3 months after that topic was chosen that the director of the Manhattan Project wrote a book called The Manhattan Project. No one knew very much about this at all. So I learned in my reading of the soldiers of World War II in 1945 who went into Japan to occupy Nagasaki and Hiroshima. They were told that the radiation was beneath the levels, so it would not affect them. And when they began to report their sickness, they were told that whatever it was not connected to the bomb. It took 30 years before the Army and the Navy and the U.S. government admitted that the impact of those weapons after the fact, the impact of those weapons upon those men had indeed produced the things that the men and their wives and their families were reporting across the decades. Now, the weapons must be abolished, not just nuclear weapons, but also every form of mass destruction weapons must be abolished. I ask us the question, what kind of people are we that we do not rise up with indignation that our own land, in spite of the lofty ideals and a history that is extraordinary, will be using its energy and resources, as it has been said already this evening, for trying to get the human race to commit suicide, trying to reduce and discontinue this extraordinary species of life that you and I and millions of billions of others represent. Well, I want to go to the second point here, namely that we have not persuaded the American people that they have a quality of life that they're missing, and that the leadership at many different governmental levels is refusing to allow us to have or to reach. And that comes then to the concluding point that I wish to make, namely, that all of the good work we are doing, somehow, we must help to ignite a nonviolent struggle in the 21st century in our country, in the United States, that will help us on the one side not only to continue to dismantle those elements of our history and of our life today that we know are wrong, unjustified, impractical, at the same moment that then that we lift up the highest values that we can achieve, namely equality, liberty, and justice for every boy and every man and every girl and every woman in every part of our land, access to life, access to the opportunity for life, access to make of themselves what God decrees their life is about, access to the resources that we have in the 21st century that can make life, human life, beyond our imagination, even maybe beyond the grasp of past history and the like. A nonviolent struggle. What we do must sow the seeds. Non-killing is critically important. I like the use of Professor Page's use of the words, a science of non-killing. I love it. May I suggest to you some of the things about Gandhi and nonviolence that are critical? Because Gandhi again and again insisted, I am experimenting with, I am offering the evidence and the facts and the history of a science of nonviolence that allows human beings to create the sort of nation and world, a community that they want. Nonviolence is a science of social change. I will not say much beyond that, but I do want to insist upon this, something that Glenn has said and also that David, namely, why is it that we are not at the place where we had hoped to be in this 21st century? Many of our ancestors wished us to be. Part of the reality is that we have deceived ourselves not only with these myths of violence and killing and nuclear deterrence, but most of all, we think that human life allows us to take a shortcut, that we can create good out of wrong or evil, that we can create human affections that will hold us together in unity out of thinking and practicing the very opposite of human affections, namely hatred and despising. Or very specifically in some of our own systems, racism and sexism and violence and economic greed, all of which denigrate human beings as being of infinite worth in the journey of life. There's a beautiful story in the 19th chapter of the book of Luke in the Christian Bible of Jesus looking down across Jerusalem and weeping and saying, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, would that even today you knew the things that make for peace, but they are hidden for your eyes. We today in our country, our leadership, our Pentagon and the rest, do not know the things that make for peace. As A.J. Musty said at one point, peace is the way to peace. The things that make for peace. We have great need for social, political, economic change in the United States. Somehow we must persuade ourselves that the arena of social change, the arena of hope for the nations, is not in the troubled places around the world where we have our hands and our resources, but in Santa Barbara, in Chicago, in Waycross, Georgia, in Florida, here in our own country. The movement of which I was a part, which represents for me indeed an exhilarating time of life, did make the impact because King and Rosa Parks and Fannie Lou Hamer and a whole host of people whose names are long forgotten were convinced, like Gandhi in a very real way, that you cannot resist indignities in life with new indignities. Gandhi in South Africa invented the term nonviolence for the first time around 1906 or 1908. And the reason he invented it is because as he was organizing Muslims and Hindus for resisting the very racist and colonialist sort of laws that were being imposed upon his fellow countrymen in South Africa, he said after great conversations and great contemplation, he said that I cannot resist this. I cannot move to change this by imitating it. I cannot challenge the government with the government's theory and the government's practice. That will only compound our difficulty. Is there in that cauldron that he coined the term nonviolence, not as a negative, but as what he says in his own writings, a positive, that love, the paramount force of life and of the universe, must be the context by which we resist the wrong that we feel and know. The reason that the movement had the energy it did in those days was because we sought to insist that what we human beings are about anyway are not the things that are the agenda of the powers that be. We're about our families, sustaining life, encouraging life, healing life. We're about the business of organizing our neighborhoods, our congregations, our schools, hoping to nurture life, not destroy it. The agenda of others that want power and domination and not where we see ourselves. And Gandhi insisted that the vast multitude of people of India and around the world were of the same mind. Harrison Ford was right. The movement of which, for which in part you celebrate my life and work this evening, was a 20-year period of intensive strategizing and action and work, of civil disobedience, yes, of martyrdom for some, of injury for others. A 20-year period where in each of those years, from 1953 to 1973, there were literally thousands of actions across the country to make a difference, in which the people, millions of us all around the country, worked on the new agenda, such as Head Start, worked in a legislative way while people were in jail and marching, worked to pull the signs down in California as well as in Tennessee. And we did this out of a sense that we could have another kind of society. Somehow in our time and in our day, and I accept this award with the personal sense that I will continue to work on it. Somehow in our day, we must convince ourselves we can have another world, we can have another nation. There is a more powerful vision that can not only hold us in the way, but allow us in the United States to find the burst of freedom and equality and liberty that will shock our imaginations, but will help us to see that we can be and will be the people history designates us to be in the 21st century. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.